When you think about food from the outdoors, you probably think about what comes from your garden, but there's a whole garden out there that you don't plant, but you can harvest if you know what and when to forage. And Sam Thayer is a lifelong forager. He's the author of The Forager's Harvest. He's also author of Nature's Garden. He's an all-around lifelong forager and all-around naturalist, and his passion for food extends to studying the origin of cultivated plants and even gets into socioeconomic history of the human diet. So it's always great to have him. We're trying to get a hold of him right now, and we're having some problems reaching him. So we are, and Judith is working on that, and we'll keep working on it for the next few minutes at any rate. I did want to take a minute to tell you about the host and creator of Radiolab. You ever listen to Radiolab? I love that show. It's really a lot of fun. And the guy who is the host and creator of it, his name is Jad Abumrad. Interesting name. It's spelled A-B-U-M-R-O-D. Jad Abumrad. He's the host and creator of Radiolab. And he is going to be stopping by Monona Terrace this Saturday at 9:30 to chat with Michael Feldman on What Do You Know? And so that's pretty cool. And, you know, Jad doesn't get by here very often. So if you wanted to meet him or see what he looks like or whatever, now would be the time. Tickets are still available. There aren't a ton of tickets left, but there's still some available. And the best way to do that, or the easiest way to do that, is to call 608-262-2201. So 608-262-2201. Or you can click notmuch.com. That's notmuch.com. And we'll hopefully have a ticket left for you to see Jad Abumrad, host and creator of Radiolab. And Sam Thayer, he's been on this program quite a few times. We've always had a lot of fun with him, and we've got him now, I think. Sam, are you there? Well, hold on a second. First, I have to push this button and push it again. Let's see if I can do that. Oh, there. Now, are you there?
Here I am.
All right. Thanks, Sam, for coming by. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, no problem. Sorry about the mix-up there.
Oh, no problem. Well, how are things going?
Great. I'm just looking out my window at the incredible fall colors of the red maple, and the red oaks are starting to turn, and the sugar maples are starting to turn.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about your book, Nature's Garden, and you've got a great calendar for when food is, you know, this time of the year, what's at its peak, or whatever the time of year, to get out there foraging, or maybe there's stuff that's still present but declining. What's best in early fall?
Well, you know, this is my favorite time of year to forage because there's so much stuff to gather. The early fall things like the wild plums, the wild rice, that kind of stuff is just getting done with, and things are starting to come into season. Wild grapes, it's the peak time to pick wild grapes right now. Also, cranberries. We have two different species of wild cranberry, plus the high bush cranberry, and all of them are the peak right now.
Mm.
Nanny berries, which is a real common berry throughout the state that doesn't seem to be very well known. It's almost looks like a raisin, and they grow in clusters on a large bush or a small tree, and they have a flavor somewhat like dates, or some people will compare them to dates or prunes. Really unique flavor.
Nanny berries, where do they grow in this state?
Well, like I said, they grow throughout the state.
Throughout?
And they like rich river floodplain soil.
Ah.
It's kind of their wild habitat, but they have done really well at coming into human-disturbed areas, and so they're very common at field edges. They like a moister soil, but you can also find them on real dry sites. And they're one of the few berries we have that is really common throughout the state, in all regions. Very common on the red clay along Lake Superior, and very common in the rich farmland in the southeastern part of the state and everywhere in between.
Ugh. Well, I'm going to have you show me or tell me exactly how to identify those so I can, I can get my heads on them.
Once you start seeing them, Larry, you won't forget them all over the place.
Well, that's interesting. And it's certainly different from wild cranberries, for example, which you're not going to find everywhere.
Right. High bush cranberries are confined mostly to the northern part of the state.
Yeah.
And then both species of low bush cranberry are also, they're scattered in southern Wisconsin only in the bogs. Most of our berries, for instance, black raspberries are just in the southern and central part of the state. But nannyberry is really everywhere. One of the things I like to collect in the fall with my family is whenever there's a good crop, we like to get a good stock of hickory nuts. And they're falling a little early this year because of the dry weather, like most nuts are. But it's right about now is when the hickory season starts, and I would say by the middle of October, almost all of them will be on the ground. And if you haven't tried a fresh hickory nut, they're like a pecan, but better. A little harder to shell out than a pecan, but they're fantastic. And hickory nuts are most common in the southern, roughly half of the state.
Yeah, and they do taste great. They are really, really tasty. Matthew in Darlington has something for us here. Matthew, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sam. This is a curious farmer.
Hey.
I did a weekend seminar with Sam a while back, and I'd like to encourage everyone, if you have a chance to see Sam in person, he's great, and his books are excellent. I picked up some acorns here last weekend, and I knew enough to not pick the ones that had the holes from the grubs, and I stuck them in a bag, and I was going to replant them this week, and some of them, as they sat in the bag, grubs came out of them. Mm-hmm. And I wondered about, would you refresh us about what are those grubs and how do you get acorns that don't have them? If they have a hole, the grub already left, right?
Correct, yeah. The hole you see in the acorn is an exit hole, not an entry hole. The grub enters there's an acorn weevil or curculio. There's a couple different species, and some of them infect just acorns, and some of them cross over to acorns and hickory nuts and hazelnuts. And it's very hard to tell if there is if an egg has been laid on that acorn, although there are some visual indicators. I can't really, explain that verbally, but I could show you. But basically, an acorn that looks perfect usually doesn't have a grub, but it's hard to explain what perfect means. Sometimes when you've had multiple good acorn crops in a row, there will be a really high level of infestation with weevils. And at least in the northern part of the state, we have seen 4 consecutive good acorn crops, and I've never seen that in my life before. Mm-hmm. And so our weevil numbers are really high this year. And so depending on what species you're collecting, if you're collecting red oak, you can wait until there's frost, several heavy frosts, and then acorns will stop getting reinfected. And then the acorns that look good, say in early November, you can just selectively pick the good ones if there's any left, squirrels and the deer haven't eaten them all. If they're white oak acorns, they'll try to sprout right away. They try to kind of beat the grubs to it. And so with white oak, they'll be sprouting as soon as they fall. Or in a moist year, they'll actually sprout before they fall. So they'll be hanging on the tree with sprouts sticking out of the nuts on the tree. And then they're ready to germinate the instant they fall.
So you're planting them, and good luck with your planting. Hope you get some good oaks.
Yeah, and he was talking about hickory nuts. How do you tell which ones are good hickory nuts? Because I know some of them have grubs in them, right?
Yeah, hickory nuts do get grubs also, although in Wisconsin it doesn't tend to be as bad as it is further south. Generally, good fresh hickory nuts, if you put them in a bucket of water, the bad nuts, the empty nuts, will float. There's always going to be a few that will sink that might have a grub in there that's just started to do its work, and then it's going to grow and eventually have a bad nut later on. But you can eliminate most of them just by sticking the fresh nuts in a bucket of water and seeing which ones float. If you wait a while and dry the nuts, of course, then the float test won't work because they're all going to float.
Yeah, they'll all float. Matthew, thank you so much for calling. Sam Thayer, lifelong forager and author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden, our guest today as we talk with him about early fall foraging. Maybe you forage. Do you do that? What's your favorite location? What do you find? What are you looking for? Do you have some memories of foraging as a kid? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. So give us a call or shoot us an email or go to my Facebook page. Actually, at the Facebook page, if you've got some cool photos of foraging or things that you found out there, love to see that as well. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. Sam, I know you just finished harvesting wild rice recently. Is there still time for people to do that or not?
You know, not really. I mean, there may be a few places where there's a little bit of rice left on the plants, but the main body of the rice season is from about August 25th to September 10th. The rice can hang on late if it's very calm weather. But we've had a couple storms that, and especially windy weather that has knocked off the rice in most places. You know, there's still rice for if people want to get out there and they can harvest a real small amount just kind of to play around with or to see the plant, or it's still a great time to go out and look at the rice beds if people are interested in finding spots to go in future years. But most of the harvest is done now.
And I love the, you know, fishing on some of those bodies of water and those rice beds are always so pretty. It's just it just really adds to your visual enjoyment of the outdoors.
Yeah, and, you know, some people that live on the lake get frustrated with the rice blocking their view of the lake or making it hard to canoe or cast. But another thing about wild rice is that it's incredibly good biomass producer in terms of it produces food for fish and food for the fish. You know, there's usually a very high fish density in and around the rice beds.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and there are some regulations that have to be followed anyway, so you need to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, if you go to the Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission website or the DNR website, they should be able to provide you with the regulations for harvest. You know, there's regulations on the size of the canoe and the size of the knocking sticks and as far as the timing of harvest. But it's very reasonable regulations that are easy to follow, and basically the traditional methods are mandated. I mean, there's very little reason to even wish to harvest outside of the way the regulations are set up. So,
okay. Greg in Kenosha has a question. Hi, Greg.
How you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I was interested in the chestnuts and wondering when they're going to be ready to harvest. And also the mushrooms, are they still around? And what mushrooms we can
Yeah, okay.
Okay, well, with the chestnuts first, American chestnuts are not native to Wisconsin. The closest they came in their native range would have been southeastern Michigan. There are chestnuts planted in various places around Wisconsin, but most of them have been killed by the chestnut blight. There are some people planting chestnuts that are hybrids between the American and the Chinese chestnut that are blight resistant, and some of those are producing nuts. But they will start falling right around now, if you're lucky enough to find any.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a big spiny husk, and so wear some thick gloves or some thick boots or both to get the nuts out of the husks if you have a source. Some people confuse chestnuts with horse chestnuts or buckeyes. Buckeyes and horse chestnuts are they look tempting. They look like a really good food, but they're actually quite toxic. And those aren't native to Wisconsin either, but they're sometimes planted as street trees. As far as the fall mushrooms, you know, there's still a fair number of good mushrooms that are in season now. And it's somewhat of a poor mushroom year because of the low, I shouldn't say somewhat, it's not a very good mushroom year because of the low rainfall.
Yeah.
But honey mushrooms are still in season. And sulfur shelf or chicken of the woods. Also hen of the woods, which is often confused with chicken of the woods by name. And it is another shelf fungi, but it's a grayish brown one. And that grows mostly on white oak. That's in season right now. It's a great time to find it. And let's see, the meadow mushrooms, which are common lawn mushrooms. And there's also the shaggy mane. And again, I'm listing some edible mushrooms that are in season right now. But of course, for any mushrooms or any of these plants, you're going to need to consult some reliable field guides in order to make sure that you have the identity correct.
Absolutely. But when you get that correct identity, you got some pretty good eating there with those mushrooms. I love mushrooms, so all kinds of them. Sam Thayer, our guest today, talking with him about early fall foraging. You may have a question or two. I hope you'll join us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Getting into early fall foraging today with Sam Thayer, who's the author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. And we have a link, by the way, as a matter of fact, on my Facebook page. If you go there, or when you go there, take a look. There's a link to The Forager's Harvest, and that'll get you right to Sam and what in that particular book and some of the things that he's doing. So that's wonderful to have, and wonderful to have him with us, and wonderful to have you listening in. Let's go to Steve in Door County next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you? Great program.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say I wish I had even a tenth of this information or knowledge that this gentleman does. I got in late, but it's fantastic. I'm a chef by trade, and in springtime in Door County, love to harvest morels, fiddlehead ferns, and ramps. And people sell it, but I give them away if I can, barter for other things, and it's beautiful. But I had a question about a particular tree that I planted, and I don't know if you can tell me this without seeing it. About 8 years ago, I planted probably 36 trees, and two of them, I thought, from this farm were maple trees. It looks like a maple tree, but it has acorns on there. Is it not an acorn? Is it not a maple tree?
If it has an acorn, it's definitely an oak.
Yeah.
The oak fruit is so distinct, there's really nothing else you could confuse it with. And so you must have some oak that has somewhat of a maple-shaped leaf. So I find that very odd.
Yeah, me too.
There is actually an oak called maple leaf oak. However, it's a very rare tree that's confined to about 6 sites in west central Arkansas. And so I doubt that's what you have. But if
you've got a photo of that tree, that would be great.
Yeah,
Steve,
well, of the fruit itself, if you of the nut-like structure, if you could email or send me that or post it on Facebook, because I'm really curious about what this is.
I don't Facebook, but what I can do after I get back home, which will be in a couple hours, I can take a picture of the actual nuts, the fruits.
Okay.
And of the actual leaf, and I'll send it to this show.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be wonderful.
If you could return, just tell me what it is. I'm embarrassed to tell you, but even the actual tag on the tree from the farm stated that it was maple, and now the tag's gone. So, I'm happy with either, but thanks for your help, and I'll send a photo in.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Yeah, that's going to be fun. Sam will get you. He'll send it to the show, and we'll make sure you get a look at it.
Okay. Well, I was just recently in Michigan, and a lot of the black oak in southern Michigan have such a broad leaf. I could see people interpreting it as looking like a maple leaf. And the other thought I have is maybe it's some sort of gall, not actually an acorn. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we'll get a look at it and find out. Pam in Galena, Illinois. It's your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for the program. It's a great show.
Having fun.
Yeah, I'm really interested in foraging. I haven't done a whole lot of it. And I'm especially interested in your guest's reference to nanny berries. There's something growing in our neighborhood that's got a reddish-purple stalk, and the plant seems to grow quite high, maybe 4 or 5 feet, and it has fairly broad, dark green leaves, and then these clusters of very deep blue berries on it, almost like grapes. Could that possibly be nanny berries?
Well, what you're describing sounds smaller than a nanny berry. A nanny berry is a woody plant, and it usually doesn't fruit until it's at least 8 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
And it will grow as much as 30 feet tall. But how large are the berries that you're talking about?
Not very large. They're...
like smaller than a pea?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm suspecting that you're talking about elderberries. Did they ripen in, say, a month ago, and they're mostly gone by now?
No, they seem to be ripening now.
Okay. I guess, you know, off the description, I can't tell you. Is it an herbaceous plant or a woody plant?
I think it's herbaceous.
Huh. Okay.
It almost looks like the stalks look to me to be the consistency of the jewel weed, you know, which pulls up a lot of moisture.
Okay.
And
you know what I'm what you say they're 3 or 4 feet tall?
I think so. They're on they're on a hill, and I'm short, and I look up at them.
Another thing that's ripening right now, an herbaceous plant, is pokeweed. The berries of pokeweed are not edible. There's some debate about that. Some sources say the seeds are poisonous and the fruit is not. But I would advise people not to eat the fruit. The young shoots of pokeweed are eaten in the spring and are probably the most popular wild vegetable in the United States. Really popular in the South. Now, southern Wisconsin is the northern extent of where that grows, but it gets pretty common almost as soon as you get into Illinois. And in Galena area there, I know there's pokeweed around, and the berries are ripening right now. And by the way, Galena, Illinois, you're kind of a little foraging paradise in your countryside there. So.
Oh.
Really? What else should I look for?
There's, the list would be hundreds of plants long. I mean, I'm not saying it's really better than southwestern Wisconsin, but that whole region is just great for foraging. I mean, the hickory nuts and the black walnuts, and there's so much food. There's plenty of nanny berries in your area, though.
Okay.
So it may not be a good year for nanny berries in your area. It depends on how they pollinate in the spring, but they're definitely around. I've picked them multiple times in Grant County, Wisconsin, and you're in good nanny berry country down there.
Hey.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for the information.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. Thank you very much for calling. You should take a look at Sam's book, Forager's Harvest. Man, that helped. Tell us about that book, by the way. What's it all about?
Well, with both of my books, what I've done is I've chosen to cover a smaller number of plants. There's some good field guides out there, but they may cover 300 plants and have a paragraph each. I've taken the opposite approach, and I have, in Forager's Harvest, 32 plants. In Nature's Garden, I have 41 plants, but I cover them with anywhere from 3 to 20 pages so I can show multiple photographs of the different stages of growth and really take the time to explain carefully how the plant's prepared, where you would find it. I just go into a lot greater detail than most of the other references out there. The downside is that I've only been able to cover 70-some plants with the two books, but the proper way to learn foraging is one plant at a time. And, I mean, each plant you learn is like its own kind of separate skill, and it's like you add this plant permanently to your garden, I would say. Once you have that plant down and you know how to find it and how to use it and how to identify it, for the rest of your life, you'll have that food source that you can access every year and have a lot of fun with.
Absolutely. Penny in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I have a question, a couple of them. I planted service berries, and this year I decided I was going to try them. And by the time I decided to try them, they were all gone. And the birds ate them all. And I wonder, what do they taste like? And are they really, are they service? Are they that useful? How did they get their name?
Service berries? Well,
the name service berry, there's sort of an etymological myth behind the name that it has to do with church services. But actually, it's pretty well established. It in England, they call that Sarvis, S-A-R-V-I-S-S, berry. And somehow the spelling got changed in the United States around 1900. So pre-1900, it was called Sarvis berry here, too. And some people still spell it that way. And that comes from the Latin sorbus, S-O-R-B-U-S, which refers to another fruit that grows in Europe. Now, it's a real common problem to have the birds pick all your service berries off before they get ripe. That's a testament to how good they are.
They are very good.
In certain areas, the only way you can get the fruit is to net your bushes because the birds just love them. And they vary in flavor from bush to bush. We have six species native to Wisconsin, and they vary from pretty good to extremely good. Really good service berries are the top of my list of all food in the world. And I say that, I'm not kidding. There's nothing I would rather eat than a service berry from my favorite bush. So.
Oh, my. Oh.
There you go. Makes great jam, too.
If you're going to buy a service berry bush, try not to get the species Canadensis or Arborea if you're going to plant them for your own fruit use. If you get Alnifolia or Sanguinea, those are two that ripen later and have better flavor.
Okay, Alnifolia and Sanguinea. I'll write that down. Okay, can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
What do you know about hackberry trees? Are they good for anything?
Well, okay, hackberry is another great food that's just coming into season right now, and this is quite interesting. Hackberry is the oldest known human plant food. It's the oldest food for which we have archaeological evidence. And actually, throughout the world, everywhere where hackberries grew, they were an important food source, particularly before agriculture. But the name hackberry gives people a misconception of what they are, because really, it's like there's a date on the outside, and then a shell that's not too hard, but hard enough to be annoying, and then inside there's a nut, like a hazelnut. So it's almost like a complete food. You've got an oily nut and a high-protein nut inside and a sugary date-like fruit outside, and they dry on the tree so they don't spoil. They'll sit there all winter long if they don't get picked off. And they were generally just pulverized to break up the shells, and then you just eat this kind of sticky, sweet paste. And it's really filling, and it's really good, and the seed shells are in there. There's just no way to get them out. That's slightly annoying, but once you're used to it, it's just fun to snack on that way. The famous wild food author Yul Gibbons said his first recipe he ever made was a hackberry hickory nut candy bar, where he pulverized hickory nuts, he pulverized hackberries, and mixed it all together and ate it as a candy bar. And I recreated that recipe, and I added just a dash of maple syrup, and it was fantastic.
Oh.
Everybody who tried it loved it. So
Making me hungry. Thanks a lot for calling, Penny. Appreciate your call. You mentioned hazelnuts, and we had a Facebook question from Bob, who says, one day the bushes are full of nuts, but it seems the next day they're gone. Are the squirrels getting them? And do you have any hints that may help us get that harvest?
I do. I have a really good hint. The hint is you got to get them before the squirrels do. And that means don't wait for the husks to turn brown. Look at the nuts inside the husk. Now, it's occasionally true that if there's a bumper crop, the hazelnuts will stay on the bush late into the fall. for any Hayward listeners, right now there's still a bunch of hazelnuts hanging on the bush around Hayward, for example, because that area had a bumper crop this year. But most years, if you want to get any hazelnuts, you need to pick them usually before the 5th of September. And this year it was probably the 1st, because after that, the animals have just taken care of all of them. Open the husk a little bit and see if the nut is brown. If the nut is brown, then it's ripe. And then pick these clusters. The husks will be kind of juicy and green, or green with a little brown or purple on them. Pick them and put them in a rodent-safe place to dry for a while, and then when they dry, the nuts will loosen up. And another hint is if those nuts don't want to loosen up in the husk, that means you either picked them too early, or it means that the nut is empty anyways. So don't waste your time fighting with the ones that don't want to come out. Those are the empty nuts.
We have Ann wonders, by the way, if you have any classes coming up. You give classes through the year, or do you have some now?
You know, I'm really done teaching edible wild plant stuff for this year. Since my kids were born, I'm not teaching as many classes as I used to. I did several workshops at an event called the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival this year. That was held at the end of August. And that was a really fun event that had several different wild food educators present. And I just got back last weekend from doing a bunch of workshops at the West Virginia Wild Food Weekend, which is sponsored by the West Virginia DNR. But that's kind of the last thing that I'm doing this fall. So if you go to my website, there'll be a schedule of appearances up there. But usually I'm doing maybe 6 or 8 public teaching engagements a year the last few years.
Okay. And let's see, Ron in Arnwood, Michigan has a question for you. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I had a question about, we had some mushrooms that are popping up in the yard, and they started popping about 4 weeks ago, kind of when we started getting some rain up here, and they're getting just more and more, and I'm wondering, how do I tell if they're edible? You can't really see the stalk of them. They're anywhere from 2 to 4 inches. They're flat and they're white.
You know, there's no shortcut to either mushroom or plant identification. You really need to pick the mushroom, get a mushroom field guide, and carefully read the description and match all the features to the written description. Particularly with mushrooms, it's very important to go by the written description. I mean, the picture or the photograph can give you some basic idea, but matching the written description is really important. It sounds like there's a chance that what you have is just called the meadow mushroom. Meadow mushrooms are a close relative of our cultivated mushroom. They come up in lawns from midsummer to through fall. They're a very good edible mushroom if you're sure that that's the mushroom you've got. So from your description, it could be that, but certainly there's no one way to tell by looking at the mushroom. You have to really match the features to a species in a field guide.
Is there any good like online sources that you could recommend for the mushroom guides?
You know, not really. There's a lot, with the proliferation of information online, there's just a lot of kind of questionable information online. I mean, your best bet is most people that collect mushrooms, you know, will have 2 or 3 field guides that they really rely on regularly. For me, I like the Peterson Field Guide to Mushrooms of Eastern North America. I've got the Audubon Society Field Guide to Mushrooms. And I'm sure your library in Ironwood or a nearby library will have a few of those, but I would check out 2 field guides and identify that mushroom. And you know what? It'll be worth it. Even though it'll take a few hours, it'll be worth it, because once you do that, you're going to find that mushroom every single year for the rest of your life, if that's a meadow mushroom. And it's going to be so exciting when you identify it and first cook it. It'll definitely be worth it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Good luck, Ron. And Don in Warren, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Question, a comment. After years of struggle, I've got some American chestnuts growing. I've planted most of the seeds up till now. How do I prepare them to eat? And the comment, many years ago, my wife's grandfather, very old man in the country, the boys would go out on a weekend and pick up several pickup truckloads of walnuts. They had a system going. They had a hand corn sheller, used to crank by hand. They motorized it. They'd put the black walnuts in there, and it would take the hulls off. Then they would take the nuts out, put them in a cement mixer, a little hand cement mixer with a bunch of water, crank them for a while. That would clean them, and then they'd put them on the floor of the hayloft in the barn to dry, and then all winter, Grandpa would sit by the stove, by the cook stove, crack walnuts.
Yeah.
I know at Christmas time, he said, well, I got 100 pints cracked.
Oh, that's a great story.
I said, is there any money in this? And he said, well, there ought to be. I've never taken any out.
Oh, Don, thank you so much.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, right here, I have this black walnut candy that I made last night. It's just maple syrup boiled down to the sugar stage, and then I take black walnut kernels, and I chop them up so they're not too fine. And when that maple syrup gets down to the sugar stage, I turn it off, let it cool for a while, and then I dump in the walnuts and stir until it solidifies, and then pat it down, and then I can cut it out in bars when it's done. And it's my kids go crazy for it, and my neighbors want.
See, now you should have come to the studio today instead of doing this over the phone and brought one of those bars along.
Well, I'll have to do that sometime, Larry, to make up for being unfindable for the first couple minutes.
Oh, man.
I forgot the gentleman's first question. He asked about chestnuts, how to prepare chestnuts.
Yeah, how to prepare chestnuts.
We don't get lots and lots of chestnuts, just as an occasional treat. But I just take the chestnuts, I dip them in boiling water. It makes them way easier to peel. And I peel them, and I eat them, just like that. You know, some people roast them, which I don't think it makes them taste better, but it makes them easier to get out of the husk. But I just love eating chestnuts that way. We've done a few chestnut recipes. You know, people use them in stuffing. They're kind of not like other nuts because they're very starchy. They're not very oily, and they're slightly sweet. You know, it tastes kind of like sweet corn. There's a lot of traditional chestnut recipes, which I have not gotten to try because I just never get enough chestnuts to do that. And after I eat about 6 or 7 handfuls, and my wife eats 6 or 7 handfuls, that's all we have.
That's
we don't
about
have
it.
Left, so.
That's about it. Don, thanks a lot for calling. Carol sent us an email from Randolph. She said, I should know by now to grab a pen and paper before the show starts because 90% of the time when I'm listening, I want to take notes. So she says, what a great show today, Sam. And again, the title of your books, Sam Thayer is the author. The title of your books?
Nature's Garden and Forager's Harvest.
And Carol, you or anyone else can go online to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We've got links there to Sam's sites and to his book. Sam, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Oh, but a big pleasure. Isn't that a lot of fun? He is a really interesting guy. He's done so much work in this area. And a fun conversation. Be fun to have be invited to his place for dinner some night, wouldn't it? All of the great foods that he finds right under our noses, right under our feet. Coming up next, we'll talk about, we'll talk about foraging again. Let's forage for good airlines here. Rick Seedy of faircompare.com. Thanksgiving. Listen to this. Thanksgiving is just 8 weeks away today. Today is, I think, 8 weeks more, and you're into Thanksgiving. I bet a lot of you are checking fares to go see family. Always lots of great information when Rick's on. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.